Thank you very much. General Jowen, Lord Lieutenant Crowden, Ambassador and Mrs. Crow, Lord Henley, Secretary of the Army Togo West, former Chairman of the Joint Chiefs General Vesey, the Right Honorable James Molyneux, a member of the World War II generation still making a contribution to his nation as the only World War II veteran in the House of Commons, to the members of the official American delegation, distinguished guests. A half century ago, on a morning bursting with spring, Hitler's thousand-year Reich collapsed in dust and ashes and eternal infamy. Tens of millions had perished, many whose names are known but to God. Americans and Britons fought side by side to break Hitler's military machine. From the frosty seas of the Atlantic to the skies over Europe, where together we dissolved the Nazi blitz into smoke and destroyed Germany's industrial ability to equip her armies. They fought together in North Africa, and then on the stark slopes of Cassino in Italy, and at Anzio and Salerno. Our young men shed their common blood on beaches called Sword, Juno, Gold, Omaha, and Utah, and in the hedgerows that lace the country beyond in Normandy, on the bitter road to Arnhem, in the snowy forests of the Ardennes, onward through the Ruhr, and in the great final push to the Elbe. Time simply will not heal some of the scars left on the reflected image of humankind, remote places that lived in innocent obscurity before Hitler came to power, will remain eternal nightmares in the darkest memories of the human experience. Auschwitz, Treblinka, Sobibor, Dachau. But at last, in May 1945, the killing stopped, and a silence of exhaustion settled down over these ancient lands. We are here today in the fens of East Anglia, those fields that gave shelter to the mightiest wartime air force that had ever been assembled. We are here because brave men and women rose to fight back against a greater savagery than this world had known since creation. More than 8,000 are remembered in these quiet slopes of Mattingly, the bodies of some lying here in the earth, the names of others missing forever in action inscribed on the walls standing here. And around the world, in the vast cartography of death that was the Second World War, lie gallant souls who brought victory, not merely for the Allied powers, but for humankind itself. The living and the dead who won this victory gave us our world, a world now buzzing with life, with stunning creativity, with invention and technology, and progress that moves in the unpredictable, exhilarating, and sometimes painful ways that progress occurs. Here in this green place, amid these trees and flowered grounds, before these rows of white stones that mark the last resting place of our honored dead, and in solemn reverence, we can reflect on the lives they gave for liberty. The dead who lie here in the mysterious silence of eternity were once like us. They were children wakened to a world that grew morning by morning in a radiance of light and discovery. They heard stories that drew them like a gentle stream into the great current of human life. They laughed. They were heard and they cried. They were loved. Fathers and mothers, wives and children loved them, and they loved in return. They knew the heat of summer, the cold of winter, the softness of rain, the brightness of snow. Before they were names on these stones, they were names in a neighborhood or a school. And to call their name was to summon up their faces, their voices, their place in the world. Leaving homes and peaceful days, they went to war. These dead here at Mattingly flew in B-17 Flying Fortresses, in B-24 Liberators, and P-51 Mustangs, into skies not unlike the firmament they had gazed at as boys, seeing changing faces in the clouds. There were the bombardiers, the pilots, the navigators, who chanced life and death in black bursts of flak and the freezing cold of high altitudes that could and often did turn warm blood to ice on the leather of flight jackets. They were the brave and gallant mechanics, the ground crews and air crews, the medics and nurses, the clerks and drivers and radio operators who were victory's unsung authors. Had they lived, some would be among you today, gathered here with us to honor the living and the dead. Some would have written books that now the world will never read. Some would have discovered new truths that now the world must still await. But most would have been ordinary people living life with its quiet pleasures and inevitable disappointments, with friends and jobs, with churches and synagogues and families, with cycles of birth and death. At rare, unpredictable moments, they would have experienced instances of love or beauty or triumph or simply understanding. But most of the time, their days would have been ordinary, the slow turning of a wheel of time in space. On a war memorial far away for soldiers long fallen, there are words that still speak to us across the miles and the decades. When you go home, remember us and say, "For your tomorrow, we gave our today." So how do we honor these dead, and how do we best remember them? Not by words alone. Our remembrance must be more profound and more enduring. We must strive with all our collective might to fulfill the promise of that great architect of victory, Franklin Roosevelt, in unspoken words that he wrote just before his death. "Our task is to want more than an end to war," he wrote. "Rather, it is to want an end to the beginnings of all wars." We the living stand in the presence of the dead to look for a world that someday will fulfill the biblical prophecy that nation shall not rise against nation, that neither shall they learn war anymore. But these simple common stones, in their orderly rows, remind us that though whole nations do fight, it is individuals who die. And the great tradition that Americans inherited from Britons holds that individuals are born with dignity and God-given rights. Our two peoples, Britons and Americans, share a conviction running like a golden thread through our common history. That gleaming thread was woven in part at Runnymede in 1215 when King John signed the Magna Carta, in part in 1588 when England stood alone once before against the invincible armada, in part in 1776 when Americans called up the principles of John Locke and, supported by Edmund Burke, asserted the right of all men to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. This is a conviction that has been won for us by brave and bold men and women through hard centuries of time. Men and women not only brave and bold in battle, but also brave and bold in books and in voices, brave and bold in forging on the anvil of experience and in the fires of imagination those ideas that make the battle worthwhile and make success a triumph of the human spirit. We honor these men and women today because they defended with their lives that shared conviction that because men and women are born free, tyranny is a monstrous affront to nature itself. It is a conviction that binds Americans and Britons even more closely than our language and culture. The Americans here came from Memphis and Topeka, Spokane and St. Louis, New York and New Orleans, from hamlets and farms, from city streets and remote valleys, and they lie together in this field. They did not want to die, but fate had called them to valor and to death, and so it was. From their deaths, we have learned enduring lessons. If we do not heed them, the 21st century, so near to us now, could well bring a descent into a darker age of barbarism than the world has ever known. The most important of these lessons is that government without the consent of a free people is tyranny, and that tyranny thrives on war and rumors of war. The tyrant always struts, as Hitler did, on a stage built of human suffering, surrounded by legions of soldiers, bolstered by the machinery of battle, and adored by flatterers with cold fear in their hearts and hollow cheers on their lips. The tyrant vainly seeks the grace and legitimacy that can only come from the freely given consent of the governed, and when he finds it missing, as he always does, he feels fear in his own heart. Part of his defense is to imprison the imagined enemy within. His tools are secret police, midnight knocks on the door, the informer, and still he fears, still he knows no rest. So the tyrant lashes out in conquest, turning the inchoate hatred of his people from himself to their neighbors, to those who are somehow different. The tyrant is not sated until his evil metastasizes in cycles of expansion and violence. Only in the roar of artillery can the tyrant drown out the accusing and fearful voices of those he has failed to mesmerize into silence. For centuries, the British and Americans have also shared the knowledge that a free people, able to write and speak without restraint, are more likely to seek peace than war. For in a democracy, citizens have a stake in their society. They own their lives, their freedom, and their property. They do not belong to their government belongs to them. And as the Second World War proved so convincingly, when a free nation goes to war to defend freedom itself, it will fight on to inevitable triumph, no matter what the cost. In that grim time, Winston Churchill asked his countrymen to so bear themselves that men would one day say this was their finest hour. And it was. And in his words, we in America heard our duty defined. First, we sent the tools he asked us to send. And then we sent our men and women, and we fought together, side by side, with the men and women of Britain and the Commonwealth. And we were victorious together in that spring half a century ago. And when the victory had at last been won, Churchill himself pronounced his judgment on the Grand Alliance between Britain and America in these words: "It would be an ill day for the world and for the pair of them if they did not go on working together and marching together and sailing together and flying together whenever something has to be done." for the sake of freedom. For 50 years we have held on to that course, even as we have witnessed incredible changes. Now we live in a world unimaginable in 1945. Old enemies have become enduring friends. Now, not only is the Nazi flag with its twisted cross a relic in museums, but the hammer and sickle is also gone as a symbol of power and fear. But of course, we face new challenges now, as we always will, for evil did not die with Nazism, nor with communism, nor with apartheid. We have seen it in our midst. It lurks like a viper in unexpected places, striking suddenly, viciously, as Ambassador Crow, a son of Oklahoma City, can attest. In standing united against such evil, wherever it threatens, let us remember that the men and women who lie in this quiet place, and in all the other places where their comrades also lie, died for a future of hope for the best that might be for those they left behind. In honoring these dead, then, let us, the sons and daughters of those who lie here and those who loved them, rise to the vision proclaimed by President Roosevelt to seek a moral basis for peace, not only here in Europe, but far beyond. Let us build democracy and freedom in a world governed by just laws, respectful of human rights, accepting the obligation each one of us has to his neighbors and to all those men and women everywhere who are bound to us by the common ties of the human condition and the yearning for decency and dignity and freedom. The bodies of these men and women rest in the bosom of the earth, their souls in keeping with God. But their spirits are with us to the ending of the world, and what they did for us can never die. To them is given the promise of the prophet Isaiah, as we pray for lives of our own to live that will be worthy of their deaths. They that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. And they shall walk and not faint.